what specific input we need to provide for the brain to stimulate and initiate those changes that we desire. Now, with many of the issues we deal with, the general perception is the job is to accept the child with limitations, to accept the diagnosis, to accept the prognosis, and to provide the child with appropriate opportunities, and essentially teach the child skills so that they can function to the best within their limitations. Our perception, based on our understanding of neuroplasticity and our years of experience of triggering that, is that we can produce.
Want to hear Bob Dillman talk?
And that the label, that the prognosis, is not a limiting factor. To help illustrate that, we'd like to have a few of our parents talk and kind of give you their history in terms of what they've experienced with their children, because it's very, very important that you perceive your kids as having unlimited potential, and that a diagnosis of autism or ADD or PDD or any of them is only a label, really, of their symptoms, and is not a limiting factor. What we need to do is address their specific inefficiencies, provide them with a specific input, and hopefully, you know, produce the degree of function that we would all love to see in our kids. Okay. So with that little introduction, Sarah, let's have some of our parents speak.
All right. Pam, how about we start with you?
Okay. Well, my son will be 19 in April, and when he was 3, received the diagnosis that he was on the autism spectrum, and his IQ was evaluated at 56. And, of course, that was, you know, like a kick in the stomach. You know, and so at that point, we had started the process of hooking up with NICD. And so I guess he was probably about 3.5 when we first came to NICD. And at that point, you know, of course, we had been very discouraged, you know, with that kind of a prognosis, you know, with what we had been told. But NICD gave us specific things to do to bring about change and to change our own way of thinking. I am a teacher, and, you know, in education, we're always so concerned with measuring output all the time and so forth. And one of the things that NICD did for me and helped me change my mindset so much, they helped me made me understand that I needed to be concerned with the input, and that the output was going to change, but don't be so hung up on it. And it was kind of like that gave me, I can't tell you what a defining moment that was for me, you know. And so for all these years, that's really how I've tried to operate, is that we have put, you know, doing the input, the work, to bring about the change. Okay? Fast forward. I used to pray that I could just get him potty trained, that I wouldn't ask for anything else if I could have him potty trained. Okay? And, you know, of course, then when you have certain successes, then, you know, I always said that I was greedy. You know, the glass may have appeared half empty, but I was constantly trying to fill it. And that's how, you know, we have operated. Well, Marcus is a senior this year in high school. And he is on the golf team. He has been number one on the golf team for the last 3 years. He is the captain of his golf team. Marcus drives. Marcus has a golf scholarship to college. You know, Do we still have some concerns and issues? Yes. But Marcus, from when that doctor told me, when I asked him when he was 3.5, when we had gone to the Meyer Center in Houston, and when I asked, I said, okay, I want worst case scenario. And he said that when he is 16, he could have the mind of an 8-year-old. You know, and then you look at my son now, he's in there working on his TRECAL homework. Okay? So we have come so very, very, very far. And I really don't know where we would be if his speech therapist had not pointed us in the direction of NACD and the work that we've done with him. I really shudder to think about it. I really do. So, anyway, I don't want to hog the conversation.
But thank you so much. That's fantastic.
Quickly. How old was Marcus when we got him out of all of his special ed classes?
Oh, what we did, we started when he was in fourth grade, I transitioned him into a regular math class. We did a lot of tutoring over the summer. In fact, when he started fourth grade, he was ahead of the other kids because he knew his math facts. He had them down cold, and they didn't. You know, so he was the star for the first, you know, for the first grading period because he was really ahead of them. Then when he was in fifth grade, at the beginning of the year, I transitioned him out of reading. And then by Christmas, I had moved him out of language arts. So by the time he was the second half of his fifth grade year, I had him out of special education classes completely.
Now, and he's a National Honor Student today, correct?
And he's in the National Honor Society. Now, I still kept him under the special education umbrella because I wanted, you know, there are certain perks and things that I'm able to use. Marcus has some accommodations, like he has extended time for testing. Okay, so, for example, that paperwork was sent in for the ACT, and he gets extended. He got time and a half on the ACT test, you know, for example. And so there are some things that we use as tools, but you cannot change the curriculum, you know, because if you change the curriculum, then they don't graduate with a regular diploma. But he has just accommodations, not modifications.
Do you remember your first brag with Marcus? Because I have it on the pink sheet.
My first brag?
Yes,
oh,
it was that you were able to eat in a restaurant as a family.
Oh, yes. When we were flying to NACD, we went out there after the first 6 months after we'd worked on the program. And going into a restaurant, especially a noisy restaurant, we always avoided noisy restaurants. We would go eat at like 3:00 in the afternoon when no one would be there, you know, because we never knew if Marcus was going to go under the table or if, you know, losing a fork would upset him or, you know, or something. And so our plane was delayed to go to Utah. So there, you know, those Fridays and so forth at the airport back in those days, especially. That's before they took away all the silverware and so forth. They tended to be kind of noisy, really noisy. And so Mike and I were like, "Oh, what do we do?" You know. And I said, "Well, we can give it a shot." We went in, we sat down, we ate. Marcus did not go under the table. You know, he ate. We had a meal like everybody else. I mean, it was a defining moment. It really was. And it was at DFW Airport. So it was wonderful because we had to plan everything around. We had to be thinking ahead, you know, what would be the least problematic going someplace or doing something. You know, we always had to be thinking ahead and so forth. And eating out, you know, was definitely a problem. Definitely a problem.
That's great. That's great. Kudos. Kudos to Marcus and his mom.
Well,
and dad, family.
Yeah, he's worked very hard, but let me tell you, one thing you have to be is consistent with what you do. That pays huge dividends. It really, really, really does. And when you pick something that you're going to work on, you know, that you don't, you know, go to the mat, you know, and persevere and don't give in.
Good. Thank you, Pam.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Wow, my story sounds a lot like Marcus. My daughter, age 3, we knew she was having problems with Marcus screaming for hours at a time.
Sorry, Beverly, I don't mean to interrupt you, but those of you that are late coming on the line, if you hit star 6 to mute your line, we're getting a lot of feedback. Okay, Beverly.
Okay. My daughter, at age 3, was having a lot of problems, screaming for hours at a time, not looking us in the eye, echolalia, not really communicating. And so I had a degree in psychology, so I started reading everything. We took her to the public school. They said, you need to start looking about autism, and she was enrolled in a special ed preschool. And I looked everywhere for things that could help, and I went to seminars and things and kept asking, what are you doing that works? And I really couldn't find people that were saying that. That they had found something, they knew there was measurable improvement, until I found a mom who had gone to NACD. So when Celeste was 5, we brought her in. At that time, she was acting deaf most of the time when you tried to communicate with her. There would be some echolalia and occasionally some speech, but there was no four-step communication. She mostly just wandered around in a daze in her own world. She loved reflections. She wanted to lick people's jewelry, a lot of meltdowns in public. And she didn't play appropriately. She just would be shaking like a little My Little Pony. She had sensory issues. We couldn't comb her hair. There were foods she wouldn't eat. She had problems sleeping through the night. There were just a lot of problems. And when I first came to NACD and the evaluator told me, you know, did the evaluation and then told me about Celeste really having an unlimited potential and I could tell she was sincere, I just because that's certainly not the response I've been getting from everyone else. And what was wonderful about NACD is they really told me what to do. We worked on improving her auditory and visual processing and then overcoming all these sensory issues, targeting the different debilitating sensory addictions she had. And then as she was making progress, if there was a problem, that would be addressed. So the program would be adjusted based on what was going on. And it was really wonderful, and I know that NACD is what made the difference because I've been trying other things before, and I have. I know that NACD is why she's where she is today. She's now 16 and a half, and she's homeschooled, but she goes through a correspondence course, so I'm really not doing it anymore. She is sending in her tests and everything, and she's getting A's. She converses very well. She's a very marvelous teenager right now. She goes to girls' camp by herself. She actually has a job at Kroger. She's a bagger. She works 10 to 20 hours a week. And she got that job by going into stores, asking if they had openings and things, and then doing all the applications online and things. And so, and she also deals with stuff at the job, like when she makes a mistake and gets corrected and things like that. She does volunteer work at the public library. She recently started going to junior college, taking one class just to see how it went. It's American history class. She got a first test. She's never taken a timed academic test before, and she got a 90 on her first test. But she said she thought it was really good. She didn't do as well as she'd wanted. The grade got curved up a bit with the class curve. But she knows how to study better now for that. She plays beautifully. She babysits. She thinks she'd like to study oceanography, maybe psychology. And she's a real problem solver. When she notices things that are not working right, she sometimes comes to me and says, Mom, I don't think you're handling this right. And she's empathetic. There was someone she was concerned about. It was one of her friends. So she said, I want to make her muffins. So she, you know, made her muffins and things like that. So she's occasionally she's verbally awkward, but I think it's in a normal range. And she's a wonderful kid doing really well. And I know it's because of NACD.
Good. That's great. But you also have two others. Could you shed a little bit of light on those?
At one point, I had 3 children on program. my oldest daughter had all the symptoms of classic ADHD, you know, bouncing around the room, could not focus. Her digit spans actually, at one point were up to 11 or 12. She got astronomical scores at college, at the entrance exams, got a great scholarship, is now studying mathematics and minoring in Mandarin Chinese, and very calm, very directed, everything fine. The ADHD symptoms took less than a year of NACD program to help. I also have a son who was diagnosed with Asperger's and ADHD, and he was much milder than my middle daughter, and those symptoms are gone now too. And he's going to have his Eagle Board of Review soon. He's 15. He's in a one-act play in public school. He's got, well, all A's, and he's a great kid.
Great. Thank you, Beverly.
Thank you.
Janine.
Yes, I'm here. Wow, I am looking toward Marcus and Celeste for my son to be there one day. He's not quite 14 right now, but when he was 3 and a half, he was diagnosed. And then I'm hearing a feedback here. I'm distracted now. So we went to NACD. He was almost 4. He was still in diapers. He was not talking. He was constantly stimming. He did not communicate. He did a little echolalia. And within about 6 months, actually less than that, within 3 months, he was potty trained. Within that same first 3 months, he had said his first meaningful word. The people that diagnosed him, they told me similar things to the previous moms. He had like 8 diagnoses. It was just absolutely ridiculous. They told me he was mentally retarded. They also told me that I should consider him dead because he was completely gone and he would never get better and he would never come back. He, 4 years later, because we had to go back and get another diagnosis, and so we went to this, you know, the same person, and all of a sudden he's not mentally retarded. And, wow, he can do all this stuff, she says. And I said, yes, I know, and we're working toward all of that stuff as we speak. He's been homeschooled these 10 years, and I didn't understand everything the law was telling me to do, but we went from things like learning letters to learning words and then putting words together for sentences, and then we went right into scripting and getting him to talk. We did all sorts of therapies for his sensory problems. He didn't get dizzy, and he had very, very low muscle tone. His ankles, his knees were falling in. He was going to have severe problems with that. And we got his muscle tone up, and then we were working on, you know, just his processing, which increased very quickly in the beginning, his auditory processing, which meant all of a sudden this whole other world of life was opening up to him. He was understanding things. Today, he's almost 14. I hope one day he'll drive a car, but he's still a little spacey. But he is academically either on level or above where he should be. He's in typical classes. He's homeschooled, but he goes to karate class. He's in a typical karate class. He takes piano lessons. We found out he has this magical ear for piano. I'm looking into some other things, but now I'm starting to tell myself, well, I have to not over schedule him like most kids are. So I think we're going to stick with these things. But the changes we have seen in him, the people just will come up and say, you know, I see him every day, but they'll tell me, I cannot believe the changes that I've seen in him since I've known you these last 4 years. And I, again, like Pam said, I honestly don't know where we would be without NACD. I mean, when he was diagnosed, he was on the left field hill looking at never coming back again. And here he is in the playing field, and he is actually doing and thinking, and like I said, we've still got work. We've got a lot of work to do with him, but he is there, and we are still working to get him where he needs to be. So there you go.
Thank you, Janine. And just to remind the both of you that are late on the line or getting on the line, if you hit star 6 to mute your line, we hear some feedback. Joanna May. Are you there?
Okay, yeah, I'm here. My son, Darren, we came to NACD. He was 2.5. And at the time, he was completely stimmed out. All he would do would be sit under a table and scream. He wouldn't let us touch him. He had totally nonverbal. He would climb walls. It was insane. When we came to Lynn at first, we came, I think mostly my husband let me come because he knew it would make me feel better. And I was really happy with the method because it taught me how to do something. And I'd had therapies in the home and stuff, and they weren't doing anything I wasn't already doing with my kid. They would come and they'd stack blocks with him. I was already trying to do that. But NACD taught me how to work with him in ways that actually made change. It took me a while to fully embrace everything. I went to a conference once, and at the conference I realized how important some of the parts were that I wasn't doing. And as soon as I started doing this, I started seeing more change. And then Lynn finally convinced me to get rid of all the stims. So we became a completely stim-free home, and we had a major change in him. All of a sudden, we had massive language, and he was interacting with people and trying to play with kids and stuff. Then we moved into doing some scripting, and that really opened up to him what words to use. He had a hard time pulling words out, so he still does sometimes. And so on. He's 6 now, and he is in a Montessori class, and he's in a totally regular ed class with no accommodations or special requirements or anything. His academics are testing at a third grade level. He's doing 4-digit addition with carrying numbers. He's fascinated with the solar system and is reading everything he can get his hands on by it. He's picking up encyclopedias and reading about it. And he will compare his books to make sure that they all have the right information. He gets very mad if something has the wrong information, and he'll bring out his books to compare it to make sure it's all correct. He's a happy little guy. He hugs everybody. He likes to play with kids. We still have issues. I think at this point, if somebody meets him, they don't automatically think he's on the spectrum or anything, but they peg him as a little bit immature. We've had a real problem with him shrieking when he gets upset at home, but we have now been 4 days without shrieking. All of a sudden, it clicked in that he shouldn't do that and he needed to talk about things. So we still have a lot of work to do, but everything is because of NACD, because they taught me how to work with my kid and gave me the tools to do it. I was able to bring him to where he is, and now I actually have goals for him and want to see him do things with his life that I couldn't even comprehend a couple of years ago when all he would do is sit and scream.
That's great, Joanna.
Hey, Anna, real quick, would you tell him about the little book that he wrote about the little boy whose mommy took his cars and wheels away?
Oh, he wrote me a little storybook. He had a bunch of pictures, and he sat down to read it to me. And the first page was, Mom took away all my cars, or something, I don't remember the exact words. Mom took away all my cars. She's mean, and gave me this look. And then the next page had a big heart, and he goes, I love Mom. And then it went on with the story about the family. So it's somewhere in there he realizes what we're doing helps him. And we'll tell now when he starts to stim, because we're getting to the point where it's not a big issue anymore, we just say, Darren, stop that. You know, just do it. And he'll look at us and goes, it does not hurt my brain. And we go, yes, it does. Do something else. And then he just moves on and does something else.
It does not hurt my brain. That's good. All right. Thank you so much. Bob?
Okay. Well, Moms, thanks a lot. You know, it's incredibly important for parents of kids with any issue to have a vision, have a perception of what can happen with their kids. And tragically, professional community has done an awful lot to limit the perception of what is possible. Sadly, largely that's because of historic failure, and historic failure is on essentially providing children with what was perceived as appropriate opportunities. Appropriate opportunities were based on perception of potential. Those appropriate opportunities were limited opportunities. To make matters worse, you know, essentially what is typically being done is skills. That is, the perception is our job is to teach our kids skills relative to what their function is, as opposed to understanding the body of neuroplasticity and the potential to really completely change to develop the brain and to eliminate the issues. You know, it's been very interesting. The last couple of years, there's been a couple of books that have come out talking about the great new discovery, which is neuroplasticity. You know, those of you who listened to our introductory CDs where I discussed neuroplasticity, those were created in 1981. And we've been actually aware of, cognizant of, working with neuroplasticity pretty much throughout my lifetime. And the basis of what we do is a basis of understanding that if we supply the brain with specific appropriate input, with specific and significant frequency, intensity, and duration, we are going to, in fact, change the brain. Now, the realities of that then become our job is to determine what is the specific appropriate input for a particular child. As of today, we have the 3,000.
Sorry, Bob? Bob?
Yeah.
Just a minute. Those of you that are on the line, I can hear people breathing and whatnot. If you'd hit star 6 on your phone to mute yourself, please. Thank you. Okay, Bob, go ahead.
I appreciate that, sir. So the job becomes developing specific methodologies, targeted methodologies, so that we are providing every individual child with a specific input to produce the necessary change. And at NACD, our perception of our job is to continue to identify where the holes are, where the gaps are, where the weaknesses are, and create the new tools. And to get better at determining which tool is going to be effective for which child. But a big part of this is really all your parents having the perception that you really, really can produce dramatic change in your kids and believing it to the degree you need it to have the, you know, the discipline to apply these methodologies consistently. You know, I think every one of the moms that you heard could testify that, you know, when they were consistently providing the input, their kids were changing. And I'm sure all of them could also tell you there were periods where things were going in life where they were not able to do that consistently. And they probably could tell you that the progress slowed down and in some cases stopped. So it's very important that you have the perception you can do this, the child can produce, you know, we can produce a change. To just review a little bit of what most of you already know, but, you know, if there's some new folks to us, the primary pieces we're looking at with children who are labeled diagnosed as being in the autism spectrum is, number one, the sensory issues. And it's very important to understand that with the sensory issues, our job is to normalize the sensory channels which are involved and simultaneously to do everything we can to redirect the kids or to produce environmental changes so that we minimize and hopefully eliminate what I refer to as debilitating sensory addictions. And it's incredibly important that every parent with a kid in the spectrum understand that all these things that are called, you know, sensory stimming or isms, our children came with a broken in a sensory channel and self-stimulating with it in a negative fashion. And essentially what happens when they engage in these behaviors is producing endorphins, and the children literally become addicted to these behaviors exactly like a brain becomes addicted to a drug. So addressing and normalizing the sensory channels and redirecting, avoiding the debilitating sensory addictions is kind of step number one. Step number two is understanding the significance, importance of sequential processing. Sequential processing is how many pieces of information you can take in through hearing auditorily or visually in a sequence, which essentially produces complexity of thought. We look at three important pieces with this. We look at how many pieces you can take in, which is short-term memory, sequential processing. Then we look at how many pieces you can take in and manipulate, which is generally what's referred to as working memory. And then we look at how many pieces you can take in, manipulate, and draw upon long-term memory, information you have in long-term memory, to further manipulate and understand the information, and if you will, think. These are the pieces that produce the global maturity in the child, permit the child to learn appropriately from the environment, to think conceptually, and to function at higher and higher levels. All right, so it's a very, very key ingredient. The next piece that is really significant for the kids is virtually any child who has a delay in the development of auditory processing and language develops an imbalance in terms of how they think. Every child begins life essentially as a visual learner and a visualizer, meaning until you have language and understand language, you don't learn through language. You learn through vision, through watching. And if you don't have language, you do not think in words, which we call conceptualization. You think in pictures, which is referred to as visualization. Now, in a typical child, the auditory and language start kicking in within months. And you end up, by the time the child's two or three, having a fairly good balance between visualization and conceptualization, thinking in pictures, thinking in words. Again, with our kids where that process is delayed, the visualization becomes incredibly strong. To give you an idea how strong that can be, I read a book last year called Born on a Blue Day. And the author of the book is a British gentleman who was, and to a significant degree, still autistic. And this gentleman on live TV in England recited pi to 22,000 decimal points. Okay. So this guy, you know, we talk about digit spans, all right? This guy recited a sequence of numbers 22,000 numbers long. And the way he did this was he actually learned it as a visual picture. And essentially he stood there for hours and read all the picture he had in his mind. Okay. That's a pretty neat trick, and it'll get you on television.
So why don't you come listen to this with me?
Come listen, it's good. But it's not a great way to be able to think and to communicate. So it's incredibly important that as we normalize the sensory channels, as we build the sequential processing and teach the child how to take in the information, and manipulate the information, that we also simultaneously start normalizing that balance between thinking in pictures and thinking in words. Your ability to communicate in language is largely dependent on your ability to think in words and to think in language. If your thought process is pictures, visualization, the only way you can communicate verbally, if you have the basic verbal skills, is to essentially tell people what your pictures look like. Many of your parents are familiar with your kids doing what we call video speak. Video speak is children watch a video a few times. They essentially memorize the video. And you hear lines from videos popping out randomly. All right, and sometimes you hear the whole dialogue from a video coming out. All right, and essentially what's happening is a child is literally visualizing that video as though they're watching it on TV, and you're hearing the dialogue come out. All right, that approach to language and communication is very, very inefficient and ineffective. One of the methodologies we've developed in the last few years is something we call spontaneous scripting. The first time it occurred to me to do spontaneous scripting, I was in Florida, and I had a family in the room with me with a teenage autistic son. And we had taught this boy to read, and we had developed sequential processing fairly well. But we had very, very, very limited language. And essentially what language we would hear from him would be rote phrases that he had learned and short little things kind of describing the picture he had in his head. And I'm sitting talking to this family, and I'm watching this boy pace back and forth in the room. And he obviously was distressed. And I'm watching him while I'm talking to the parents, and I realized, you know, he's distressed, and he doesn't even know why he's distressed, because he mentally is not able to form a picture to tell him what it is, and he doesn't have the mental words, the conceptualization, to form the thought to understand what his problem was. And I brought the child over to me, and I wrote a sentence on a piece of paper, and I had him read it. And he read, "I want to get out of here." And he read that, and all these lights came on, and he said, "I want to get out of here." And he went straight to the door and out the door. And it graphically illustrated that this boy could not process that thought because he did not have the words. And I discovered, you know, looking at that further, that if we listen to what the children say, and more importantly, if we listen to what the children do not say, we can get a very good understanding of what they think and what they don't think. It's often been believed that, you know, our children have all these thoughts in their mind and can't get them out. Well, I think the reality is the thoughts aren't there. I think what we hear is generally a pretty good reflection of what is there. So, for example, you know, if you're child in the spectrum has never looked at you, Mom, and said, "Well, Mom, you look nice today," or, "Mom, are you tired?" or, "Mom, what would you like to do?" I think you can bet on it they've never had that thought. What you probably hear them, you know, express is, "I want to drink. I want this. Go out." All right. It's a short list, and what you hear is a reflection of what they think. Now, the question became, how do we change what conceptually is in their minds, and how do we then get that reflected in the language and communication. And that's where we use spontaneous scripting. So essentially what we're doing with spontaneous scripting is, you know, we are writing out what we want the child to think. For example, you know, Dad comes home from work and we write a script on a whiteboard or something that says, "Hi, Dad, how are you?" And we have Johnny read, "Hi, Dad, how are you?" And we assist him if necessary with reading, "Hi, Dad, how are you?" And the act of doing that, the child is processing those words and beginning to establish a conceptual framework for those thoughts. And then Dad says, "I'm fine, how you doing?" And actually responds as though the child has spontaneously said that. And this process of using spontaneous scripts, we just keep increasing the complexity of the scripting. And in so doing, we increase the complexity of the conceptual thought. So it's become, you know, a very, very strong, powerful tool. And it's not one of the easiest tools to communicate to parents, and we generally have to go through a process, you know, for a number of months of getting input in terms of how they're doing the scripting and modifying it. But when we get it down, it becomes a very, very, very powerful tool. Obviously, part of the foundation of scripting is reading. Unfortunately, most of our kids, we find it's fairly easy to teach them to read. Reading comprehension is a more difficult process because the comprehension is, again, largely based on the conceptualization. And what we find with the spontaneous scripts is using the spontaneous scripts produces the conceptual thought, and that then helps us get the reading comprehension going as well. So one helps the other. So a new tool that we've developed that, you know, has been very, very helpful. Now, if we take it another step, all right, we've taken the child and we're normalizing the sensory channels, and we're building the sequential processing, we're giving him the pieces with which to understand what he's seeing and hearing and basis of thinking. We're building the conceptual thought. And then often we have a child for whom the next big step is having a conversation. And conversational language had presented its difficulties and challenges. And as we looked at that and tried to understand what was going on with that, we realized that if we kind of questioned the kids in terms of their depth of knowledge, essentially the material with which to have a conversation, it was incredibly shallow. You know, I could ask a 15-year-old child to tell me about his father, and I might get an answer like, "His name is John." And I'd say, "Well, tell me more." "He's my father." And, you know, push, maybe I get something like, "He lives in my house." And then I would try to pursue it further, and I'd ask questions like, "Where's your father work?" Often no answer. "What does your father do for work?" I might get a global answer to that. You could ask a question like, "Where's your father from? What kind of car does your father drive? What does your father like to eat? You know, what's your father like to do when he's got free time?" And I would typically discover that I could pick almost any subject, and the child's frame of reference and knowledge base was so shallow that a conversation wouldn't go past a single question. So in order to, you know, we identified that problem, and then as a solution to that problem, we created personal reference books. And this has turned out to be another great tool for us. Personal reference books, essentially what we do is start off with a couple categories and a subject in each category. So a category might be family, and the subject might be the child's sister. A category might be sports, and that subject is basketball. And what we would do is we first question the child relative to what they knew relative to that subject, and we would list those things they knew. So if it's their sister's the subject, we find out what they know. Okay, they know their sister's name. Maybe they know their sister's birthday. And that would be it. So we would list those specific things. And then we would list maybe three additional things. Where she goes to school, who her best friend is, what her favorite color was. And then we would have initial conversations with a child and say, tell me about your sister. And they tell you her name and what else. Well, I don't know. So we'd have them go into their personal reference book and look at the information there, and with that reference book answer those questions. And we would continue with that until the child had learned that information and could respond and use that information without referencing his book. Yeah. At that point, then we'd add more information onto each of those subjects, and then begin to add more subjects in the categories and continue to add categories, and essentially build a frame of reference, a knowledge base, and essentially teach the child how to organize the information in their mind, how to think in greater depth about these things, and how to communicate with. So that's spontaneous scripting. And again, it's been a progression. You're getting the conceptual thought and then taking the conceptual thought further in terms of providing the child with a knowledge base and teaching them how to access that information. Okay. So these are a couple of the newer tools. Another new tool that we've come up with and a problem we identified. Most all the kids in the spectrum have auditory tonal issues. They have frequencies that they're hypersensitive to, they're overstated, frequencies that are understated. And we've been, developed a listening program years ago, utilizing the listening program, and that's been a really great tool for us. But we identified, there's more issues relative to the auditory, and a big one we identified is problems with finger cramp. And it's been an interesting process as we've explored finger ground. Finger ground essentially is being able to isolate the specific input from the extraneous input. And what that breaks down to is being able to generally attend to language and filter out, tune out the extraneous sound in the environment. As we were developing tools for this, we developed some tests, and developing the tests was a very interesting process. Essentially what we did is we recorded words, and then we played the words in isolation, and then we played the words with different background sounds. And all of us were supposedly relatively normal hearing. We're amazed at how much more difficult it was to hear many of the words. Well, for our children in the spectrum who have significant problems relative to that auditory tonal processing, we realized that their finger ground issue was much, much greater even than ours was. And what we developed is a targeted sound intervention, focused attention program, which essentially is a program to address specifically that figure ground problem. And since we launched that, we're very, very pleased with the changes we've seen in our kids in the spectrum in terms of their ability to focus in on language, tune out the extraneous. And for many kids, we found that a lot of the frequencies, a lot of the sounds that had been really upsetting to them, they've learned not to tune into those. I think what was happening with a lot of the kids is their brain was hypersensitive and acutely aware of those frequencies. So the brain was almost always trying to find them. And as we've used the TSI-focused attention, the kids' brains are learning not to attend to those sounds. And we do much better on developing than the tonal processing, the auditory sequential processing, and then the language and conceptual thought. So all those pieces are coming together. Our process, as I hope you can hear, is a process by which we continue to work to create a better and better understanding of where problems are, where issues are, and try to either find tools or create tools to better address those problems. So that's what we're doing. I'd like to open this up at this point to questions, and let's permit you to ask questions relative to anything relative to what we've discussed or anything at all in terms of your concerns or questions or issues relative to kids.
I have one question.
Yes.
Hi, Bob. This is Vidhu Sriram's mom speaking. We started trying scripting from last quarter, so from last 3 months. We are working with Sriram on that. My major concern is that he doesn't realize that he's supposed to say what I write. He reads that as if it's like any other sentence, and he looks at my face for an answer, but I don't think that he's getting the total idea at all.
Okay, are you having him read it with you or just read it silently?
If the sentence, like if we just do a sentence with 3 or 4 words or so, I let him read it. But if it is like a little bit bigger than that, I will read it with him.
Okay, we need him to vocalize it. And if it's a matter of you reading a word and then repeating the word as you point to it, that's fine. And then it's important that after he has vocalized that, that you respond appropriately to it. You know, so, you know, initially you might want to be scripting things that produce a significant result for him. You know, like, I'd like to go outside, you know, I want to eat. But things that when he says that and he elicits a specific response, it has significance. Then as he gets starts getting the idea of it, then increase the complexity. But it is necessary that he vocalize it. He cannot read it silent.
So if the child is not doing that, would you suggest something for it?
If he's not vocalizing it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as I say, if necessary, you read it word by word and have him repeat each word.
Sriram is nonverbal, so...
Okay, well, if he's not verbal at all, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, totally not verbal.
Okay, if he's not verbal, then you need to keep it really simple, and you need to make sure that the responses to what he said are very significant. So, essentially, you're at a point where all you're trying to do then is get him to understand that the words have meaning.
Okay.
So you're at a real basic.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you completely.
Yeah, you're at a basic level, and you're just trying to use it to get them to understand the words.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, you know, often kids are not speaking because they do not have conceptual thought. They're not thinking in words, and you're at a point where we're just initially trying to get him to think in words.
Okay.
And, you know, kids, you know, for example, you know, Janine talked, you know, with Luke, you know, you use scripting, and often, you know, for a long time, we didn't have a whole lot of really meaningful language. And as he started doing more scripting, he started getting the conceptual thought, and then the language became meaningful.
Right, and we would do things like jump up, and then we would jump, or shut the door, and we would shut the door. So she got it, I mean, eventually, what the words meant.
So take advantage of the job is to put the words, concepts into their mind, and when we succeed in doing that, then we'll get the right expression.
Okay. I think I made it a little too complex for him, and
he's
not getting the idea at all.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, make sure you keep in touch, and everybody, you know, is understanding what you know, give us specific things that you're scripting so we can help assist them.
And I'm gonna cut in here. Those of you that are on the line or if after you're done asking a question, if you'd please hit star 6 to mute your line so that we don't have a lot of background noise, please.
Bob, I'd like to ask a question since you were talking about sensory issues. If you are familiar with Erlen colored lenses.
I am.
Do you feel they help?
They were developed out in California, I'm trying to think, in the 80s. I honestly haven't seen significant changes with them. I think for some kids, simply the fact that you're producing a change temporarily increases some attention. But I've not been able to really see in terms of visual function what it is really trying to take place. So I haven't been a fan. I have on occasion seen some kids who have used it and the families thought they saw a significant change. But I haven't seen anything beyond what I would think would be a product of just producing a change so the child attended a little bit better because something changed. Let me bring up another piece here relative to the spectrum. One of my concerns is that virtually all the research into kids on the spectrum and virtually all the attention out there relative to the spectrum is on biomedical treatment of kids on the spectrum. And I'm concerned with this because the perception kind of is it's that we have a disease. And if we have a disease, then maybe there's a pill that can fix the disease. And you know, we're not dealing with a disease, we're dealing with a developmental disorder. We've had a lot of families through the years that have spent a tremendous amount of time and money doing some pretty intense biomedical intervention. And more often than not, I mean, we're constantly looking for what works, and I don't care what works. I'm delighted to find anything that works. But unfortunately, the reality has been our experience has been generally the more intensive that work, the greater problems we're having with the child. Let me ask, you know, the moms who spoke earlier, could I have you chime in and just tell us to what degree, I mean, we want to do healthy diets and we want to eliminate dairy and you know so forth, but to what degree those of you have seen some really dramatic changes in your kids, how intensively did you do the biomedical intervention?
I can chime in right now. This is Jenny. We were pretty intensive with the biomedical, and we did some sort of a detox. We did glyconutrients. We were doing everything to get, like, supposedly get the heavy metals out. And quite honestly and frankly, we saw zero change with everything we did. It was like $20,000 that we spent over the years doing this with him, and we really saw nothing. The only thing that really worked was the NACD.
Bob, I'm not sure if the Texas families are still on, but
I'm still here.
Are you still there? Would you speak up then if you'd come on?
Oh, I'm
sorry.
Think back to what you know. I mean, because we had his hair tested, and you know, we looked at different things, and you know. I can't say that we ever saw any real change, you know.
But, and y'all did not do the intensive biomedical.
No, we didn't.
Now, Pam, you mentioned you did fast forward. Did that make a lot of difference?
Yeah, we did fast forward a couple of times. We did the fast forward. I think there was two. I'm trying to think back. And the fast forward, we saw some improvement. You know, we definitely did. Marcus did it. He worked with a speech therapist, the same one for many, many years, and he did it with her and kind of pioneered it here. And we did see some improvement, you know, there. But I have
to
say,
what is fast forward?
It's a computer program. And I can't even now. I know this sounds terrible, but so much has happened in the past few years.
Let me answer that for you, Ben.
Okay, thank you.
Fast forward was a program developed out of research at Rutgers.
Right.
And essentially, what the research addressed was a very specific auditory issue, which is the rate at which you can process phonemes. So. There's a very small percentage of children where the rate by which they can process the phonemes is slow, which means as they're listening to the first sound of the word, they're kind of missing the second sound of the word.
Marcus would do that. You know, like he would want to call words. He would see the first part, and then he would immediately not even the rest of it. You know, he wouldn't necessarily look at it, you know, or hear it, and so that did help. But I can tell you, the biggest impact was when we got to five digits on the digit span. You know, language we got significantly more language. That was kind of another defining moment for us.
The fast forward, by the way, one of our staff was one of the first people trained in fast forward, and it is one of the tools we use.
Right.
But we use it infrequently because, as I say, it's a specific. You know, there's a number of different auditory issues.
Right.
And that's perhaps the rarest of them.
Right.
But if you've got that issue, it's a good tool for that.
Okay, thank you. What is the digit plan?
The digit spans, you know, where you do with the auditory processing. Simply Smarter.
Digit spans are auditory and visual sequential processing tools.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and essentially the correspondence in auditory sequential processing or digit spans is very high correlation with receptive and expressive language,
mm-hmm.
Global maturity, and cognitive function. So virtually all families are very familiar with
that was a big step for us. It really was.
Bob, can I make a comment? This is Clarabelle, Elena's mom.
I wanted to make just a comment, not necessarily had a question. And I know this call. Hello?
Hello?
Sarah, are you talking? Did we lose Sarah? While we're waiting for Sarah to...
Bob?
Yes.
I was just going to state, both of you, there's a lot of feedback. If you could please hit star 6 on your line, if even after you've spoken. If you haven't spoken and you haven't hit star 6, if you could please do that to mute your line. We hear kids. We hear a lot of feedback. Thank you. Claire Bell, go ahead and speak.
Oh, okay. Thanks. I had several aha moments today. My daughter has been diagnosed with a significantly developmentally delayed, but we've done it all. She's been in 6 different schools. She's only 7. I went from Montessori to the speech to a $17,000 a year half-day program speech school to now public school, and have tried. I'm also the biomedical. We did hyperbaric oxygen therapy. We took her off of gluten and dairy. We took her through all kinds of testings. So she's been through quite a bit. She also had febrile seizures. So I was worried that, you know, possibly that affected her, brain function. And so a lot of what I read today, I was at the car dealership just getting my car fixed, and I was like, well, let me just read this article. You know, I when you said, do you get the newsletters, it didn't click until after I read the article that this was for me too, because we're all in the same bubble. And I practically broke down at the car dealership in tears. Well, I did actually break down in tears. I was out, had to step outside because it was one light bulb moment after another, after another, after another, because it broke it down so clearly. And I've never heard Elena describe so accurately, in words. It was hard for me to describe it. So a lot of these characteristics are very similar in my child, who has not been diagnosed as autistic, but, they were, she's come a very, very, very long way. We just started in July. And so we haven't been on the program for quite a year, and I tend to underestimate the progress that she's made, although we have tried, I think, mostly everything we can up to this point. This program, she has to read for the first time. She could not read. They were trying to teach her phonetically from Montessori school at the age she was 1.5. And so she is doing amazingly well with that, and just picking up different things and learn and picking up memories. I mean, the memories, like certain things that I think, she's just never going to remember that because she doesn't retain a lot of information. She's picking up things from years ago and is talking about them in a way that makes sense, that makes connections. And I know for a fact it's only NACD has been the change in our lifestyle. And so we're pulling her out of school to homeschool her because they want to put her, they don't want to redo her IEP. They want to put her in a mildly intellectually disabled class. And Bob said, we don't want her thinking that she's any less than wonderful. And that is what has stuck in my mind. And so I wasn't really confident in my capabilities as a parent to make sure that she got what she needed out of this program that is so phenomenal, because we were only really doing like 50% with the time that we had to do this and school. But she had spelling tests, and she started getting like 100s on her spelling test in this class. So I'm like, okay, something has to be clicking. Something has to be doing well. And then when we made the decision to pull her out, I said, forget it. We're not even going to study for that word. We're going to do our NACD words, and we're not going to do those words. And she got 9 out of 12. We didn't study them once. And this is a child who could not read 4 months ago at the age of 7. So she's almost 8. So I just wanted to say to other parents out there, it definitely works. I can only imagine what's going to happen when we're at more than 50% and working further along. I mean, it's hard to express in words.
but I wanted to say that. That it's not just for children with autism. It's a, we're all in the same bubble. We all have similar characteristics, and it's all one underlying issue, the process.
Great. Well, thank you. Sharon, are you on?
I'm here.
Hi, Sharon. Hey, folks, this is Sharon. Sharon's a physician from Israel who is here in Utah training so she can help bring our work back to Israel. And she is an autistic son as well. And Sharon has done extensive research and evaluation of the physiological issues with our kids. And, you know, Sharon, would you just share your thoughts with us, please?
I can share my experience that I have a son who's 15 years old, diagnosed with autism. We started program, I think it's now 7-8 years ago, and when we were doing just program, we were seeing progress. Things were going really great, and then the biomedical intervention started to be a very strong trend, and I followed with that. And I saw that the more interventions I did, the worse things got. We went really, really, really backwards. And then I had to reevaluate this whole situation. What do the kids really need? And what it comes down to, yes, they need nutrition. They don't eat the proper foods. And so you need the basics in there. But the very, very strong detox that people are doing now is quite harmful. And just as the children are very, very sensitive in many ways, in vision, in hearing, in touch, they're also very, very sensitive to what we put in them, the supplements. And I realized that the less I give, the better he does. When the doctor tells you to give a full capsule, if you give a quarter, it works better. And I can give an example that he needs melatonin to be able to fall asleep at night. And I was trying to give him a milligram, which was the dosage, and he would just get fired up, and the doctor said, get the dosage even higher, and it was getting worse, and I found out when I gave just a sprinkle, it works perfectly. So we have to be really, really, really gentle when it comes to supplements and biomedical interventions.
Great. Thank you, Sharon. Sharon's been really nice to have around. Her background and experience in all the biomedical areas as a physician is phenomenal. And she's helping to give us some better understanding and insight to these issues as well. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time. Any other questions anyone like to ask? Comments?
I have a question.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
If you have a child, well, actually my son is 18, who is a visual stimmer, how far do you go as far as removing things? Like he has a calendar in his room that he marks the days off. He plays his PlayStation. I limit it to a half hour a day. But he'll find things like he'll take a tablet up in his room and start writing things.
Melanie, come here. What's your biggest
I just
symptom?
Don't know how to.
Part of what has to happen is determination. You know, when we're dealing with an individual, we really have to look at their pieces. Everything he's doing may not be debilitating sensory addiction.
Here.
You may have some things, for example, that he perseverates with that are not necessarily addictive behaviors. The video games, may not be a harmful thing. They might possibly be a positive thing. For example, if we have a child who is visualizing 24/7, if they're involved with processing visual information, as with a video game, they cannot simultaneously visualize. So it actually can be a positive thing if the child is visualizing too much. If the child tends to engage in debilitating sensory addictive behaviors a lot, and we might find that engaging in a video game actually occupies them in a safe way that's not contributing to the addiction. So, you know, to say when we're dealing with an individual, we have to look very carefully at the behaviors to determine which ones are addictive behaviors, which ones are just learned perceptive behaviors, and which ones are absolutely fine. I can't tell you, you know, with those specific things with your child, you know, which ones are good, which ones are bad, and which ones are indifferent.
John.
So we'd have to look at all the pieces in terms of the sensory function, the balance and the visualization, the conceptualization, what's on the list of things we can engage a child in that's appropriate. How much downtime they need. So it ends up being a very individualized, rather complex picture that we have to evaluate.
Okay, let's get to bed.
Okay, any other thoughts or questions, folks?
This is Pam again. I just want to reiterate again that I really don't know where we would be if we hadn't come to NACD, because you really did give us the tools to work with our child and bring him forward. And I will always, always be grateful.
Well, thank
you,
Pam.
Can I ask one more thing?
Yes.
Hi. I'm wondering, would it be necessary to come to Utah and meet you and have you meet my child? He's 10, almost 11, and very auditory, it's really blown up over the past year where just the very, you know, slight sounds just really are grating on him so hard. And that's my biggest thought. My biggest thing was this auditory, you know, somehow trying to develop a program for him that he could handle sounds better. Is there any perfect place to start?
You know, evidently you're, you know, new to us. We have chapters around the country.
Okay.
So, you know, you could be seen in any of our 15 chapters.
What's closest to Cleveland?
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, okay.
Okay. So we're pretty close. And
okay.
And relative to your concern about the auditory, I don't question there's significant auditory
tonight
issues.
Tonight is 10:30. You've got to go to bed.
But,
I cannot go to bed.
But you cannot.
Oh, no, I
whoever
can't,
needs
friend.
To go to bed, go to Star Six.
No, that's not gone.
Bed's
gone, yeah.
It's very important to understand that your child has to be treated as a whole individual. And you cannot just look on one piece and produce significant change.
Okay.
Okay. All the pieces have to be addressed pretty simultaneously.
Okay.
For you to really produce a change. And, you know, and that's part of why things are so tough out there is we've got lots and lots of practitioners who work on a piece.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes they get, you know, they're close to getting a piece right, often they're not, but you really can't just work on one piece. You've got to look at that child as a whole and look at all their pieces and determine, you know, which issues are paramount and to a degree address all of those primary issues or you're not going to produce significant change or lasting change. Okay.
The listening program is very good, though, for that.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, it was really wonderful for Marcus. It really
okay.
was.
Okay. A lot of the moms that spoke up started when their kids were so young. I'm a little hesitant because we've done ABA, he's in a teach classroom, that kind of thing. But so he's doing relatively well, but, I mean, we still have a lot of these issues.
Don't let age be too big a concern for you. We have individuals in their late teens, early 20s, and mid-20s before they even start.
Okay.
Fortunately, the neuroplasticity exists as long as we're breathing.
Good. Thank you, guys.
Okay, all right, well, thank you.
You're welcome. Well, folks, I thank you for joining us. If you haven't seen our DVD on autism, you might watch that or read the article. Big thing to understand, regardless of the degree of involvement of your kids, the involvement or the lack of function at this time does not say that you cannot gain function. The lack of function is not not a limiting factor in terms of what the potential can be.
Bob, can I say one thing, brag on Marcus?
Yeah.
Monday he played in a golf tournament with over 80 kids, and he tied for first and lost in a scorecard playoff.
So,
anyway, I just wanted to, you know.
There you go.
It was really exciting. He was really happy. So, anyway.
Congratulate him.
Okay, I will. And thank you for letting me participate.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you. Okay, well, everybody, well, thank you very much. And if we can be of any assistance, you know, give us a shout. And those of you who are on program, you know, try to do as much of your program as you can and keep in close touch with your coaches and your evaluator. And make sure, you know, if you've got an area where you're not too sure you're on the mark, now, let's talk about it. Make sure we're getting everything nailed down. We're all doing the best job we can. Okay. Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.